Anybody doing any of the, oh, hi. Anybody doing any of the hands-on labs yet with the private cloud hands-on labs? Anybody doing any of those yet? You haven't? You did one? How are they?
They're good.
So, well-designed?
PowerShell 3
is good. How is it set up? So you just walk up and just do it? Oh, very cool. So it's not like you have to wait for a time and there is a time slot that you go to. You just walk up and just do them. That's really cool. I know some of the other conferences set up, you know, time slots, and so there's this sort of cattle herd of people trying to rush in and get it done. And very cool. Yeah, if you're new to TechEd and have not spent a minute or two with the self-paced labs, head on down there. Literally, it's just click, then click, then click. But there's that interactivity to it that really kind of helps, you know, drill this stuff home. You did PowerShell. Anybody else do any other ones? No? Not yet? Yeah, spend a minute over there. It's a lot of fun. Who is this? Who is your first? Is this your first tech ed? One, two. Oh, really? Couple. That's pretty cool. Welcome. Welcome.
What?
You work for a cheap company. So this is your first tech ed. What has your experience been so far?
So far, so good.
What's the most interesting thing you've learned, either good or bad?
I really love seeing the PowerShell 3. There's a web front end.
The PowerShell web front end.
Any browser, any phone, anything you can launch PowerShell.
The PowerShell web front end that you can launch from any browser, any phone, any anything.
Any
squirrels in, you know, running around in circles, driving web browsers, anything. That's pretty impressive. You know, it's funny too. PowerShell is awesome. Like, have you had your like PowerShell epiphany yet? Like, you know what I'm talking about. Like, when it's that moment where you go from get dash process to, oh God. You know that? Like, I have goosebumps just thinking about it right now. Like, oh, you could do this. Like, that's the cool part about PowerShell, when you can finally hit that epiphany. Has anybody played with PowerShell as it relates to Office 365 yet? There's some pretty sick coolness. My company, Concentrated Technology, moved over to the OS 365 platform. We were one of the first customers. And just being able to take that 5 or 6 lines that is the connection string for connecting up to Office 365 and throwing it in your dollar profile is just really awesome. So from that same command prompt, from the same PowerShell window, we can manage the local machine, we can manage remote machines on the domain, and also the Office 365 instance up in the cloud. You know, just by running commands. Unbelievable. It's funny how we're starting to turn into Unix admins. Well, we don't have to grep set awk. We it's like Unix administration with objects. What about the food? Was the food better this time?
No.
Yes?
No.
No. Wait, let me, okay, yes.
Yes, the food is a lot better than MMS, I'll tell you that.
Okay, who says no? No? So the food last year was, I think the food was so bad last year that one of the executives apologized. Now, if in terms of tech ed sessions to go shows to go to and shows to not go to, if you didn't go last year, you did miss the 132 degrees it was in New Orleans last year. Or 2 years ago in New Orleans. Yeah, that was the hottest thing I think I've ever experienced, 132 degrees. Even the New Orleans people were like, we're sorry about this.
Next year.
I know, I heard. So yeah, Tech Ed does return to New Orleans next year. Should be interesting. New Orleans is, you know, like you come to a place like Orlando and at the end of the day, you're like, I'm gonna go have some fun, you know, hang out with the guys. But when these shows, they go to Vegas or they go to New Orleans, there's this sort of expectation of a party when the sun sets, am I right? Any good parties? Anybody attend any good parties last night?
No. We stayed at home and played with PowerShell.
None? I'm not allowed to tell you where the parties are. There are a few out there. So if this is your first time here, so one of the worst kept secrets about tech ed is that there are these after all the knowledge is done and your brains are full for the day, there are these parties that go on, and a lot of times they're sponsored by different vendors in the expo hall, and finding them is sort of a secret skill, I think. You might troll around the expo hall and see where they might exist, because, there's usually a good couple dozen of them throughout the week that where you can go and get free beer and sometimes some food as well in exchange for listening to someone's product pitch. Worthwhile in my book. We'll start here in about, I think I see just short of 5 minutes or so. And for those of you that are sitting on the ends, this poor gentleman here, it's his job to tell you to let people through. Hopefully we'll fill the house. How are you? Walking, standing around, the usual. I have 90 slides. This is a new personal record, if we can pull this off. So it's kind of funny, actually, because so like 6 months before every tech ed is when they announce what they call the call for papers. And so the call for papers is when you submit the sessions that you think you want to present. Back at VMware, or VMworld, last year, I did one called 16 of the Biggest HA and DRS Mistakes. And I thought, aha, that worked well, because we got a whole room full of people, so I'll try it again. And I just made up a number. But let me tell you what. If you do that and you make up a number and figure, hey, you know what, if they pick that, I'll just fill it with 22 things, that's a lot of things. to fill. So we have 75 minutes and 90 slides. If you have a long question, may I ask that we leave it till sort of the end of the presentation? If it's a short question, then throw it out. But, 22 is a lot. What's I'm saying? Yeah, you gotta lead people through the nose through all those mistakes. All right, has anybody here made 22 mistakes? Yeah, exactly. It's at some point. You think of those mistakes. There's the lowercase m mistakes, and then there's the capital M mistakes. You know? Yeah, or the all caps mistakes. The resume producing events? Yeah. Yeah, don't give yourself an RPE or a career limiting move. Oh, and yes, as I am just being told now, there are microphones in the center of the room if you believe your voice not to be loud enough, and if you have a short question during the presentation. The longer questions that we will save to the end of the presentation, and then I'll march outside, and then we'll have a little round. So we are at just about 1:15. I got 40 seconds until 1:15. Are you guys excited to be here? Isn't it about time that we're finally back at Tech Ed? I mean, seriously, like, so let me ask you, is this like one of the big events for you? Like, this is your week to get out of the office and to go learn and finally get, you know, caught up on all the stuff that you didn't know about for the last 12 months? Oh, man, it's like 51 weeks go between now and the last time that you actually get to catch up on all this stuff. You know, there's just nothing like going to an actual conference, right? Because you can, you know, you can read books all day long, or you can set them on the shelves like I do after I buy them. Or you can read Technic articles, but you have to kind of get out of the office once a year and just get away from the madness and the tickets and the work orders and all that stuff to really kind of learn for a period of time. I can't tell you how many Tech Eds I've been to. It's been sure a lot. It may even border on double digits at this point. But this conference is just, it really is a lot of fun. And it's just as much fun being up here as I think it is being down there. So I thank you for the opportunity to get to talk to you here for just a minute. So we are at time. For those of you coming in just now, welcome. This entire presentation will be done using the Socratic method. So I will be pointing at you and asking specific directed questions at certain portions during the presentation. So please pay attention. No, not really. Really, I have 90 slides in 75 minutes, so I'm going to try to get through these as fast as I can while still, you know, delivering information to you and you getting something out of this. At the end of the day, my goal is for you to circle the number 5 or 4 or whatever it is on that evaluation, right? That's my pandering to your mouse hand as you're drawing these out. So, welcome. This presentation is titled 22 VDI and RDS Mistakes That You'll Want to Avoid. And I presume that you're here because you may believe that somewhere in your environment there is a mistake waiting to happen. You're also here at this point wondering who is this ponytailed guy standing up here in this red shirt, and why does he keep bantering about with all these not terribly good jokes? Well, that's my job, is to warm you up. My name is Greg Shields. I am a senior partner with a company called Concentrated Technology. That's concentratedtech.com. I'm an MVP. I am a vExpert with VMware. I'm a CTP with Citrix. I'm generally a good guy and would love to go have a beer with you at some point. And Microsoft has brought me here because my MVP is in remote desktop services, and also because I've been working with RDS since back in the day when RDS was called NCD WinFrame. Anybody else remember those days? Yeah, buddy. Do you remember the 8.5 by 14 folded in half, the instruction guide for WinFrame? I think I still have it somewhere. It was awesome. So, all right. Let me ask you a question. Really? Okay, we're talking about RDS, we're talking about VDI. Has there been a technology so hotly debated as VDI? Has it really been a technology? I mean, we've got a lot of people out there, you should do VDI, you shouldn't do VDI. VDI is great, VDI is terrible. In fact, so just to kind of figure this out, I actually went to a certain search site, as to be unnamed, and started using that search site's name in a verb, and looked up a couple of things. Okay, so I want to know, is VDI really what it's supposed to be? So I started binging around, and I asked, okay, so is VDI complicated? And look, lo and behold, I find here on this website, I find out that VDI really isn't complicated. But if you just scroll further down in the page, you find out that, in fact, it is. And yeah, exactly. This is from Microsoft. So I go, all right, well, then, obviously, is this thing the future? And I see, look, well, all right, well, VDI is the future. And then a little bit further down, I find that it actually isn't. So I am ultimately confused about this entire process. And in fact, I love the top one here, because if you read it, you'll find out that, well, VDI is the future, you will save money, all users will benefit, and only VMware has it. So with that, you know, there's just a lot of stuff out there about VDI, and really, what's a reasonable IT pro to think? If you drink the Microsoft Kool-Aid, completely. RDS and VDI are slowly kind of becoming kind of almost kind of the same kind of thing, almost not really kind of. And so there's a lot of confusion out there. RDS has served us very well for a very long time. It's been around since NCD WinFrame. I mean, the first digit in the years was a one back then. VDI is newer. It's sexier. It offers something different, and so we perceive this difference as obviously it's got to be cooler because it's different, right? So is really VDI a better way to go? I introduced this because in order to talk about the RDS and VDI mistakes, in a way we have to talk about kind of the way of thinking mistakes. I joke with a lot of people that I spend more time trying to talk people out of VDI than anything else these days. And it's not so much that it's a bad technology, it fits a lot of use cases. But in certain circumstances, there are reasons why people might implement it that are, in many ways, kind of the same reasons why this old, boring technology we think of as terminal services still exists. In fact, the way of thinking mistake number one is in all of the deployments that I've seen and had the opportunity to work with and view and work with people, one of the way of thinking mistakes number one that I see is just simply thinking that you need VDI. And again, not in any way attempting to say that this is not a good technology for certain circumstances. But in a lot of cases, most of us actually don't need it. Think about the reasons why you implement VDI, right? I need to deliver application access to anywhere. I need a consistent experience across devices. Okay? I need security. I need to centralize data for reasons of security. I want to reduce the effort and the complexity in managing my desktops. Are these some of your reasons? Well, you could argue that they're the same for RDS, too. Right? With RDS, I have a server, and on that server are applications, and that server applications, they are now connected via devices, and they're secured because they're in my data center, and I can reduce the effort and complexity to manage the desktops because I have a small number of RDS desktops. The problem, and even the, you know, in a way, even if you kind of look through the Microsoft documentation, you kind of almost see this too, is many people sort of underestimate the level of skill that's required in doing, in being successful with this somewhat complicated technology. So, my company, Concentrated Technology, concentratedtech.com, we decided one day, we're gonna sit down and come up with all the different layers that are necessary in order to create the entire VDI stack. And we're gonna put them up in a nice graphic that we can then run around to conferences and use as a way to burn time. But also to help people understand, well, what do you have to know to be successful in this technology? And we were surprised at the result. You think of a virtual desktop here in this nice gray box, but we've got an OS and applications and a user workspace that all require provisioning, virtualization, management. We've got the hypervisor layer down here. We've got the endpoint receiver and management, the transport protocol, and all that stuff. So if I come off a little bit harsh about VDI, it's not necessarily that it's bad. In fact, it's far from bad. Rather, VDI is simply a heavyweight solution for certain problems that works well in some cases and not in other cases. And in fact, if you're good with servers, there's an argument that your server skills will get you everything just about to the bottom of that line, and that there are a number of new skills and new requirements that you have to be successful with this technology that sit above the line. Would you agree? Would you agree? Who here has done VDI these days? Are you happy with it? Got one, you're happy. It's because you're the smart one in the room. So a well-known analyst whose name shall remain nameless once told me that, and this was a couple of years ago, that the number one product going on in IT today was VDI deployment, and also the number one most abandoned product project in IT today is VDI deployment. So yes, it's there. Here is an interesting thing. I'm an IT analyst. I'm a consultant. Okay, I spend time traveling around, talking to people, hearing their concerns, helping them with technology. And you know what's funny? I still talk to people who haven't figured out group policy yet. You laugh. Have you? Who here hasn't figured out group policy yet? No, I'm kidding. Don't raise your hands. We're not going to, you know, single you out. But in order to really kind of get there, and I say this because when we get to the RDS stuff, you're going to need to kind of have this in order to be successful with RDS as well. You kind of have a fairly large scope of technologies that are required to be successful when you're deploying on desktops. Okay. Nobody disagrees with me. Okay. So here's why I bring this up. And if there's any one thing you take from this 75 minutes today, it's this. I believe that one of the reasons why we are so focused on VDI and we are so focused on these technologies has to do with that. That almost in many ways we're focusing too hard on the desktop. Let me ask you this. Who here is excited about Windows 8? Raise them high. Okay, like all five of you. And that's not to say that Windows 8 isn't exciting, right? But what if it's not that Windows 8 isn't exciting? What if we're just no longer excited about desktops anymore? Think about that. For years, you were told this unfair message that VDI is the answer, and the answer is VDI. Right? You remember these days? There was the war between Microsoft and VMware. All that marketing message going out. But here's my argument. The reality is that desktops are a container for applications. Desktops are a container for applications. Who can, you've got, who's the least intelligent person in the room? Okay, so when you are going to work and you're doing something with this, it's called a computer, what are you working with? Like, what are the things you're working with? Outlook, right? And if Outlook works there, and it works on your phone, and it works on your the iPad is the thing with the large phone, it makes you happy. Well, okay, so it's there, right? That's the thing. When you ask our users, well, what does this machine do? It's so I can actually work with my applications. Here is an image that I've been trying to push around to anybody that'll take a look at it, because it explains all these reasons why none of us are really excited about desktops anymore. Because at the center is the user and whatever devices they're working with. And we have these beautiful installation and streaming technologies that we can take from some application storage and send it off either directly to that person's computer or off onto some server somewhere. This is traditional RDS. Or terminal services, or NCD WinFrame, if you're still using that. And over here, we have virtual desktops. We send the applications off into here, and now we have these nice four ways in which we can deliver those applications to the user. I can present that application on a desktop, or just as an application. That makes sense. In fact, Microsoft's whole stack actually sort of follows this. If you line up all the technologies that exist now, and this is just the 08 technologies, we're not even talking about 12, RDS sits in this sort of left-hand column. Hyper-V and RDS and VDI sit in the right-hand column, and App Virtualization System Center kind of sit at the bottom and managing the applications. So it's almost as if we're all here, because in fact, the desktop is just not as exciting as it used to be anymore. Would you agree? Maybe Metro, yeah. That's even sort of a window to a desktop, almost. It's almost a delivery mechanism. So with that in mind, what I've done is I've broken apart the VDI mistakes from the RDS mistakes. And I mean, they're two technologies, and one kind of layers over the other one. But I wanted to help you recognize, out of the umpty million different implementations that I've had the opportunity to work with, well, where are some of the common failures? Where have people just not really gotten their mind set straight? And some of these you may look at and go, well, duh. Because they are that way. But you'll be surprised how many times somebody like me goes into somebody like your place and sees this happen over and over again. So may we begin? Let's talk first about the first RDS mistake you can have. It's actually deploying a terminal server. I could see that as being your first mistake, or more specifically, just deploying one. Anybody here try to deploy more than one terminal server? What's the one word you would use to describe that process? A little tough, isn't it? In fact, I write the Geek of All Trades column for TechNet Magazine. And back in November of 2011, I have a 1,500-word limit on this column. I attempted to try to document the exact steps that were required to actually put another terminal server next to the one that you already built. That's the column right there. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it in 1,500 words. That's a problem. And in fact, the secret message from the RDS product team that I'm supposed to relay to you is, oops, sorry about that. You know, you have to go through all kinds of steps. These are five steps from that article. Build the second server, move your config control to group policy, install the broker, sign the servers to a farm, network load balancing, turn on RD web access, turn on RADC, all this stuff that's required to go to two hosts. Is that not ridiculous? I mean, really. So let me show you in 2012. You'll notice that these demos sort of have us lean to them. With 90 slides, I have exactly how many seconds each demo will last. So I want to show you in 2012 how this process gets simpler. Okay, are you ready? So here's how it works in 2012. You want to go and add another host to an existing host. There's Server Manager. Click on Remote Desktop Services. Scroll down. Go over to RDS Session Host and right-click. That's the process. Yay. Thank you, RDS team. And that's really it. That pulls that host into the farm, and you're essentially ready to go. That process is strangely one of the biggest reasons, or one of the biggest investments that really has been put into terminal services in this version, is to make this whole process that much simpler. One of the other pieces that has really been improved is the entire process of doing load balancing. And in fact, when you go out today and you look at the 03 and the 08 and the 08R2 installations that are out there, you find a bunch of busted load balancing. You find a bunch of load balancing that was not designed very well from the get-go. The reason is because most people don't recognize that load balancing in 08, 08R2, 03, and NCD WinFrame, I made that last part up, involves two entirely separate mechanisms. First is the broker, the RD or TS connection broker. That's what defines the farm. The RD connection broker is nothing more than a tiny little database that just keeps straight who goes where. But it doesn't actually do the load balancing. A lot of people get tripped up because they don't realize that they have to have some secondary load balancing mechanism out there to accomplish this. Right? That can be network load balancing, or NLB. That can be round robin DNS. That can be a third party load balancer if you want. Interestingly enough, we fixed that, or they fixed that, in Windows Server 2012. Now, of the two different load balancing solutions that are out there that are available from Microsoft, there's this notion of round-robin DNS, and there's this notion of an NLB cluster. And where you see a lot of environments that have problems and they don't really understand why, these environments have problems because they've actually followed the instructions that Microsoft gave them. On the TechNet website, if you go to the TechNet website and ask it, how do I actually load balance terminal services, it will tell you to use this process called round-robin DNS. Round-robin DNS is, well, for lack of a better term, it's the cheater's way out. Because a round-robin DNS, if you have a failed host, what happens? It's still round-robins that a failed host. So it's not a really great solution. It can't actually recognize those failed RDSH hosts. So the solution, at least in the 08 days, and the 08 R2 days, is to simply install the NLB service. It's actually incredibly simple. Install the NLB service onto each RDSH host. With that on each server, you then create a little cluster through its little cluster wizard. You tell it to cluster this port 3389, which we all know is the terminal services port, sorry, RDS port. And there you go. What's interesting in the 08 and R2 days, if you try to manage an NLB cluster from a member of the cluster, you get a weird error message. So this bottom one is a recommendation to just install the NLB cluster tool onto your machine, and that will save you from this little error message that is very annoying when it pops up. That makes sense? Anybody doing this? Or with a third-party load balancer or whatever, something else other than round robin. Now, this is still sort of not very cool, right? There's still a lot of extra steps that are required. So in 2012, the load balancing process is one that is also significantly improved. And this is the part that just makes you get tickled because of how simple this can really be. Check this out. So I have here a Windows Server 2012 server. And I go to my RDS zone, and I've got my little services set up. This is just straight out of the box. And then I right-click, and I choose to create a session collection. And poof, it just works. I now have a collection of two machines that are load balanced because of this load balancer that exists between the two. The load balancing services are built into the product now. And the process to deploy them becomes far, far simpler than what it was before. So improving the entire process of load balancing across the different hosts in a cluster is one of the major investment points with RDS and Windows Server 2012. We have a few people here that have multiple machines, right? Multiple terminal servers that are out there. And one of the problems that you see as you start going around all the different environments in the world is, in fact, dissimilarity between those different environments. And this is not to say that you can't do dissimilar servers. You couldn't have one terminal server, one RDS server that is designed for the needs of the marketing department and another one that's designed for the needs of the sales department. But if you do actually load balance these terminals, these remote desktop servers together in a farm, the farm assumes that each server is similarly configured. So in order to get the failover that you would think of, you have to have servers that are similarly configured. Okay, do you know this? Were you also aware that the farm assumes that each hardware piece is exactly configured the same? Not very well known. A lot of us don't have the luxury of just buying all the different hosts that we need at the same time, and so consequently, we have to sort of assemble a farm of servers out of the equipment that we have on hand. Well, when we do that, one server may be more powerful than the other servers. And baked here into the RDS properties under RD Connection Broker is this little checkbox here marked Participate in Connection Broker Load Balancing, where you can identify in your own fuzzy terms what the relative weight of this server is compared to the other ones. That ensures that we load balance the right number of users out to the right different machines that are out there. Is anyone going, oh, I need to go fix this? Number five, it's actually manually configuring anything. So who here is not allowed to use group policy? Anyone? No, all of you are allowed to use group policy. You'd be surprised. Whenever you're actually out talking to people, the number of individuals in this world that are forbidden from using group policy and preferences is actually fairly significant. And so what happens is when you're creating servers that are intended to be mirror images of each other or copies of each other, without the assistance of group policy, it becomes very difficult for you to ensure that similarity over time. And if you play with RDS for any period of time, you know kind of the three general locations where RDS settings typically get set. Obviously, we have to set them here in group policy under remote desktop services. The whole series of stuff that will define what the RDS settings are for that machine. But there's more than just RDS on those hosts. We've got applications. We've got users. We've got different things that the users are using. And so actually turning on loopback processing mode and then also turning on one or more group policy preferences locks down those applications in a consistent and profile-driven way to ensure that every machine that gets in that organizational unit has the right settings. It is my recommendation to you that every setting, anytime you have to click a button on your RDS servers, do it through group policy preferences. Really. Because then you don't have to worry about undoing that or redoing that later on as you add more servers to the pool. Is anybody doing this? Anybody using these tools effectively? What's your success with it? And if you need to go and add a seventh terminal server, you just shove that thing in and it's good to go. If group policy isn't your bag, we do have System Center too, and deploying those same settings out via some System Center or third-party tool. Now, a lot of people have had some real heartburn with this whole notion of similarity when it relates to the different RDSH servers that are out there. And it exists because for many of us, well, we need help from Microsoft. Right? Group policy is great, but I mean, as you can probably attest to, there's some effort that's involved with putting all these things in group policy, am I right? Well, Microsoft has heard your request. And in the 2012 version, what they've done is take that kind of single server management experience and have, I get it. Was it important? Take that single server management experience and then merge it together to create what is effectively a single pane of glass. With that single pane of glass, you can then go about more or less automating the process of server deployment and configuration. This single pane of glass presents one location from where all of the different hosts that make up your RDS farm eventually get managed. Here, in Windows Server 2012, there's that remote desktop services deployment. Here I have the two servers that are available for management. If I go down to the collection, which is the collection of the two servers that I'm working with here, I now have the ability to take a look at all the different remote apps that are deployed to these hosts. I can take a look at the servers themselves and manage the servers themselves, again, all from the single location. It's almost like we're pulling some of the features that were available in that other product that layers on top of RDS into RDS. Funny how that works. So this, again, is intended to present a much more unified experience for you whenever you're working with your RDSH hosts. Okay? Thoughts about that? Awesome. If this sounds like a commercial for 2012, it's not that, you know, I don't make any money when you buy SKUs, but when you take a look, you know, very specifically at, gosh, when you take a look at this right here, where'd it go? Here? This little screen right here is just amazing. This deployment overview screen. Remember how this worked back in 08? I got nine different screens that I look at. I got nine different control panels to work with. Well, now I have a licensing server. I have a gateway server. I have my RD web access server. I have my connection broker server, and I have my terminal servers, my RDSH servers down here at the bottom. Very graphical, very easy to understand, and really, really improving the whole management experience as it relates to an RDS infrastructure. So, all right, I've got everything locked down. I've got everything fairly well defined. My users are coming in and doing their, you know, doing their usual thing. Well, all right, I've got a pretty stable environment. What are some other really big mistakes that people have seen? And one of the big mistakes, and it's almost not so much a mistake, but just as a kind of a, something to be careful of. And that's the whole notion of redirected folders. In fact, a top secret sort of hidden RDS MVP inner circle Easter egg is the fact that we hate them. Now, admittedly, they are sometimes a necessary evil. You know, there's sometimes that you need to centralize just the experience, whether it be start menu or desktop or whatever. And the only way to really do that fairly well in 08 and unfortunately in 2012 also is to use redirected folders. So these can be a little challenging, and they tend to create a single point of failure. One hopes that these may, or another way to implement these may get implemented at some point in the future, intent. But redirected folders, useful for certain things, but can actually, you know, kind of create some also some issues down the road. Any thoughts about that? No? Yeah, they're there, and there are even certain elements of them that when you implement those elements, they just, there's timing issues and things like that. So hopefully someday, yeah, in the back. The question was, is this an all or nothing thing, or is there any, are there any safer ones to use than others? Typically, the safer ones to use are the ones that would tend to have the least use, if that makes sense. And I'm actually not kidding on that. you know, start menu items and things like that. Good question. Is anybody here from the RDS product team? Hope not. Oh, God. We love this product. Actually, I knew they were coming. Number seven, is Bob in here? Bob, are you here? Jane, are you here? Is Bob, are you impacting Jane's performance? You know this, right? All right, do you consider yourself an RDS admin? Do you? Don't you, okay, we're all RDS admins in here. Let me ask you a question. So, don't you think, honestly, that the RDS admins of the world are some of the smartest IT pros in the room? I mean, for reals. Like, not only do you have to deal with server stuff, you also have to deal with desktop stuff at the same freaking time. Right? You're an RDS admin. Give yourselves a round of applause, RDS admins. Right? Why is this so problematic? Because you're not an administrator, you're a babysitter. Right? User A tries to open a 9 million page PDF on your RDS server, what happens? User C tries to play Halo. If anybody figures out how to do that, call me. Or software, I used to do RDS in software, you know, in a development environment. Oh, you want to talk about people kicking off software builds? Woo! So you may or may not know this, but in 2008 R2, there was this technology that was sort of quietly introduced for RDS called Fair Share CPU Scheduling. I believe it was also called Dynamic Fair Share CPU, so it kind of had a different names depending on when you Google it, I mean Bing it. Fair Share CPU Scheduling in R2 is turned on by default. And in fact, it might be, just by itself, the greatest reason for you today to move to 2008 R2. Are you familiar with it? What Fair Share CPU Scheduling did was it told Bob that he was using all the CPU, but didn't actually give all the CPU to Bob. If Bob and Jane and 8 other people, so a total of 10, were on a server, and Bob used 100% of his fair share, how much would that be? So if Bob, Jane, and 17 other people were on the server and he used his share, what would that be? I'm kidding, no math. You were told there would be no math. So fair share of CPU scheduling is on by default in 2008 R2. You can turn it off. You can also, and here's the really sexy part, you can also tune it with the Windows System Resource Manager. WSRM is one of those tools that you ignored. You looked at it, and went, I have no idea what this is for, and then summarily forgot about it. But what WSRM does, specifically to terminal services, is it has this policy called weighted remote sessions. And there are 3 different sort of settings in here, premium, standard, and basic. What this does is it allows you to tune what percentage share specific users and groups get over other groups. Aha. Now think about how you could do this, right? So you could give your executives standard, the marketing people basic, and yourself premium. And you get a huge share of that, of those CPU resources. Now 2008 can use WSRM, but it's a more reactive approach. It doesn't actually use fair share. In Windows 2012, things actually get quite a bit better because we now have fair share for CPU, for network, and I believe for storage, am I right? So all 3 of these now, somebody not only tries to open up the 9 million page document, but the network and the CPU get fair share. Little Easter egg, that's what it looks like. Go home today and turn on FSRM on your server, and then look at this weighted remote sessions resource allocation policy here. Hit the properties button, put in whatever users or groups you want to turn on, and give them whatever policy you want. All of a sudden, you can now dial down those nasty, nasty marketing people. What does marketing do anyway? They always ask them, and they always want max. This policy, and correct me if I'm wrong, this policy is specifically for RDS, but the other policies you can use for other reasons. So like IIS, for example. But WSRM is not specifically just for RDS, no. Remember, because Citrix is sort of a management layer over the top of RDS. They are inexorably tied together. So cool stuff, huh? This thing is fun. You can actually turn it off. In fact, that's the group policy setting there to turn it off. But it's turned on by default in R2. A great reason to move to R2 if you're still at some reason or still at some other version. And then when we get to Windows 2012, an even better reason because we can do by network and also by storage. Neat, neat stuff. Really neat stuff out there. So, all right. Those were the RDS mistakes. What do you think? Was it worthwhile? Thank you. Thank you. Hopefully it was worth your time. So how many people here, let me ask you again, because I think I did already, who's considering a VDI project right now? You're thinking about it. Okay. Hopefully this will become useful to you as well, because there's a couple of really, again, sort of foundational mistakes that you can make when you're at this point in your VDI consideration process. Some of these, again, are kind of duh, but others I want to make you think. Okay? Let's think about these. VDI mistake number 1 is actually doing VDI because of application incompatibility. You're like, oops, that was my idea. In fact, letting application compatibility force you into VDI is almost kind of a challenge here because, well, admittedly, not every application runs in top remote desktop services, but more actually do than most people think. In fact, a lot of the applications that are out there that don't work on top of RDS, a lot of times don't do so because their installer doesn't work on RDS. It just puts things into the wrong place. or it puts configurations in the wrong registry hive, or puts user configurations in the common or system files, or doesn't isolate per session these really complex developer type things. Now, Microsoft has done some really good, is really honestly done a great job of creating multiple solutions for this problem. Number one is the application compatibility toolkit, which if you haven't spent much time with, is a toolkit that assists you with taking Windows XP applications and upgrading them to Windows 7. Beautiful, 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 really hard to use little tool. The second is another really beautiful tool here called the RDS Application Analyzer, which for some reason was buried for a long, long time on Microsoft's website. And so not a lot of people are aware of it. This is an analyzer that will take a look at an application and give you some really good guidance on how to make an incompatible application compatible application. Neat, yay. There are also application repackaging tools. When you add AppV to VDI, you really kind of get over some of that app compat stuff. And then these two items down here at the bottom, the product team wanted me to add. I did under duress. No, I'm kidding, guys. I'm kidding. But the idea here is that the enhanced device compatibility in RDS and remote effects with software GPU actually take the applications that you wouldn't have thought could run on VDI or on RDS and make them run on RDS. So Halo, for example, right? That's actually a good question. I would love to see that. There are coming up a couple of sessions that'll talk about this advanced device compatibility, so the ability to plug in like your USB rocket launcher and have it work through RDS, which is honestly just sweet. And how RemoteFX with its new software GPU takes a lot of applications that you would never in a million years think of putting in an RDS and making it run really, really well. Like, it's impressive. Number two, there are two different ways in which you can deploy VDI desktops: personal virtual desktops and pooled virtual desktops. And one of the mistakes that you see people try to do is replicate their physical environment and their physical mindset into the VDI world. So, okay, I'm gonna go VDI. Here's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna P2V all my desktops and throw them on top of Hyper-V, and now I'm virtualized. Yee. Personal virtual desktops are useful when significant user customization is necessary. Right? You have a bunch of people that need to have their own desktop scenario, and they've got to have their own settings and things like that. You have users that need to be administrators, and you want to put them in VDI because you just want to. Well, that's one reason why personal virtual desktops can work. But the problem is that personal virtual desktops are arguably VDI's most expensive deployment today. Imagine how many petabytes of snot are sitting around on your desktops right now. And how many dollars per gigabyte are you spending for those little hard drives that you probably buy at Best Buy? Now take that and put that on your extremely powerful, high uptime, 100% available SAN storage. And you can see where stuff starts to get really, 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 really expensive very fast. Now, there's a little item down here that says it costs less than Windows Server 2012. It may be dubious, but there are some new, I'll talk a little bit later on, about some of the new ways in which our Windows Server 2012 can reduce your storage costs. But personal virtual desktops really accomplish nothing towards reducing your management effort. In fact, they double it. Why is that? You got to have a device to send the desktop to. And until we can figure out a way to plug a USB or Cat5 cable into their brains, or FireWire, I don't know, whatever we'll have by then, you still have to have something there. And you're still managing those desktops like physical desktops because you're having to use all the tools that exist. So if VDI mistake number two is implementing personal virtual desktops, well then VDI mistake number three is implementing pooled virtual desktops. Just as challenging, right? In fact, going to the pooled route, okay, here's why it's awesome, right? Why is it awesome? When I have users that have the same application suite or similar applications, when I have users that are doing kind of the same thing, right? A lot of users that are performing the same thing with similar applications, and I can reduce the amount of deviance from that, deviation from that whole scenario. That's where pooled virtual desktops come in handy. Customization, very low. Or I can apply certain technologies like user disks to strip out all of that stuff. Well, that actually creates a pretty decent use case for pooled virtual desktops. However, when you go down the pooled route and you're creating these pooled desktops, aren't you kind of just creating a bunch of little RDS servers anyway? Really? I mean, there are some apps that don't work in RDS, but a pooled virtual desktop is like a whole bunch of little RDS sessions. In fact, I forget who said it, but you know, VDI, there's nothing like VDI for taking a 100 concurrent user RDS server and turning it into a 10 concurrent user VDI server. What is interesting, though, if you're going to go down this route and you're going to implement pooled virtual desktops, which really is the better plan, in the old days, as in before yesterday, it was very difficult to create or to deal with these disk management. Right, if I wanted to go and actually make a change to a disk and then send those disks out, well, that was a major pain in the, whatever that last letter is. It's a major pain in the administrator. Microsoft has actually added in 2012 a new little feature that allows you to refresh these desktops in an automated sense that makes it a little bit less of an administrator problem. In fact, recreating that virtual desktop can be done with just a couple of clicks. Here's how it looks. So here, on my 2012 server, I have my virtual desktops down here. I have my RD virtualization host, which is a Hyper-V server. And if I look at a collection of virtual desktops down there, I simply choose to recreate all virtual desktops. With that new golden image, I can say, all right, well, based on a schedule or based on when the user's logs off, go ahead and just send out those changes to all the desktops and make them all compliant to my new security requirement or my new application that I've deployed. What do you think of that? That's not, anybody here had to do this manually before? It's not fun. Not fun. So, number four, and this is one that I bet you didn't know about, because it honestly was the most brilliant thing I've ever seen, and it was the most not really well-known thing I've ever seen in 2008 R2. So, back to our Outlook problem. At the end of the day, the user's interested in, you know, Outlook. And if I deliver it via a virtual desktop, or if I deliver it via a physical desktop, or if I deliver it via the tablet, thank you, by the way, do they care? Do they? Is anybody's users care? So if the users don't care, and if it's the apps that they're concerned about, and it's really the apps that we care about these days, because no one's excited about desktops these days. Well, wouldn't it be cool if there were certain situations where I had an app that didn't run on RDS, but I still wanted to make it available remotely? So when that app didn't run on RDS, I'd want to put it on its own computer because, well, it's easier for me. I can't figure out how to make it work. But I don't want to give anybody complete access to a whole desktop just to run that app. I just want them to have access to the app. Why wouldn't I use VDI for that? Think about that. So in the classic VDI sense, an application on a virtual desktop is presented as inside that virtual desktop. Doesn't this sound like how we used to do terminal services back in the days before remote apps? Who's still deploying desktops with terminal services? Hold them high. Thank you. Who's deploying remote apps these days? So why not just make the source of the remote app, instead of it being an RDS server, why not make it a desktop? Now, this is a technology that actually was released and nobody knew about it in 2008 R2 called Remote App for Hyper-V. Little known, not very well integrated. In fact, it was almost kind of a test to see if this would work. So what would happen is you would install that application onto a VDI desktop, and then when a user wanted the application, the connection broker madness would go and orchestrate booting up that VM and then launching that app and then sending it to the user via a remote app. It might take a second or two extra, but they can deal with that. And poof, they have access to the app. And when they're done, everything shuts down and it makes things go back to the way they used to be again. I can focus on the apps. This gets better in 2012. In fact, this gets completely integrated into 2012, and it's called VM-hosted remote apps. And this is the technology that you should pay attention to today, because this is what you can actually make VDI work for you in a less, in a cost-effective way for specifically the apps that are important to you. Think about that, right? So in my VDI world, I open up my little RDS application, little doodad, and then from there, I go down to the collection that I've created. And from that collection, I click here on Remote App Programs and just simply scan the virtual desktop for all the apps that it has and present that on my RD Web Access server or through my remote access and desktop connection. And the users now have access to their applications. Is that not cool? Who thinks it's cool? All right, do you feel like you came to the right session now? Okay, good. That's gonna be really powerfully amazing, and it's honestly one of the reasons why you really will wanna move to 2012 when it comes out, because the integration here is just really, really, really cool. You will have to have I believe it's the enterprise version of Windows 8 to do that, and in Windows 7, you'll have to have Windows 7, it's SP1 plus the 8 integration bits, right? Okay, so you can even do this with Windows 7 now. There's some integration components for Hyper-V for Windows 8 that have to get installed. There's a whole white paper on it. So go take a look at it, because it's really cool. So in the few minutes I have left here, actually more than a few minutes, I want to talk about some of the other big mistakes that people have. The first of which is ignoring latency. And if you're any kind of RDS admin worth your salt, you're familiar with the 200 millisecond rule. Or at least you know it, you could intuit it. And it's not really a rule, and it doesn't have to be 200 milliseconds. But there is a certain number of milliseconds of latency between a server and a client above which the users just simply refuse to use RDS, right? VDI is the same thing, same protocol. Same issues apply. Now, what a lot of people forget is the fact that the latency can actually source from multiple different locations. That latency can occur when desktops are not close to the users. So if I'm here and my user's all the way on the other side of the world, well, I have that, what is it, 80, takes 80 milliseconds or so for light to get all the way around, not to mention the switching delay. My desktops can also not be close to their applications, or the printers, or the peripherals that the users have to worry about. So when you are thinking about where to host these VDI desktops, pay careful attention and be aware that too much latency will create a situation where the users will not be able to do whatever it is they need to do. You heard about, I keep hearing these rumors that Cisco's working on these quantum entanglement routers. Have you heard about this? You're on a spooky action at a distance? You seen this? Anybody here watch Discovery Channel? So you take a particle, and you take another particle, and if you vibrate this particle, then the other one vibrates, and you can separate it by infinity, and the other two, they still are connected. Wouldn't that be awesome? I don't know if they're actually doing it or not. I'm just making this up. But it would be cool. Vibrate it over here, and it vibrates over here, and suddenly there's no latency ever for anything. Now, in the real world, there is a new feature in 2012. In fact, it's a feature that existed in 07 that you also ignored. And because you ignored it, Microsoft actually sort of took some of it, the control out of your hands, if you want to choose to help with this latency problem. What else can contribute to latency? Turn it on arrow, right? Turn it on letting people print 9 million page print jobs. You know, there's just more data that has to go through, and when there's more data over a limited pipe, well, the latency can go up. So what they did was take that whole connection quality screen. You know this, ever remember this screen? The one on the left is from Windows 7, and the one on the 8 is from Windows Server 2012, a la, one would assume, 8. And on the one on the left, this is where I would go and punch in the name of a computer that I would want to actually connect with. Do you remember this tab over here? The experience tab. You know that one? Did you pretty much just ignore that tab for pretty much the entirety of your professional career? Why did you? Because we don't think that way. You know, and our users surely don't. Okay, user, when you're on a modem connection, now click this, or when you're on... They're not going to do that. So the idea was that when you select these connection speeds, it would adjust what the experience was with all these different items down here in the bottom. Well, in the new 8-wave world, look at that. What does that say? Somebody read that. Detect connection quality automatically. Notice what else isn't there? Those little checkboxes aren't there. So in the newfangled 2012 and 8 world, the remote desktop client will actually do all the smarts on behalf of the user, because everyone knows that a script is always smarter than users. Now, if a user's coming in over a latent line and the connection initiates over that latent line, the connection quality can get adjusted so that we can preserve the best user experience by turning off things that are pretty. And that's really what that is. It's a little feature, but it's a really potentially very powerful feature for whenever you're working with those clients. Does that excite you? I believe it auto-sense. How often does it auto-sense? How often does it auto-sense? All the time. So, I can't answer that. And it's not because, it's just because it's simply I don't know. Yeah. And you're going to need it for remote effects. So, fun little tool here that you might have missed otherwise. So if latency is how long it takes stuff to get through the drain pipe, well, bandwidth is how wide the drain pipe is. Right? I mean, if you do a lot of flushing of the toilet, funny story, I was doing a conference where the keynote speaker said, okay, when Johnny Carson says, good night, everybody, everyone flush the toilets in the hotel, this was years ago, don't do that, because the bandwidth of the toilets is not wide enough for all the flushing to occur at the same time. True story. And we're not allowed in that hotel anymore. So, if ignoring latency is a problem, ignoring bandwidth is another problem. This is a classic graph with RDS. Pick two. You can either have a good experience, low bandwidth, or low CPU, but you have to pay one of them to get the other two. And this is just known. In fact, one of the tenets of remote effects is sort of focused around, I'm going to try to pick the better one of these that sort of supports the experience that I require. In some cases, I want a better experience. In other cases, I want lower bandwidth. In a third case, I might want lower CPU. But this is generally the rule of thumb in terms of what you would get out of that experience. I had a big long argument with the product team because they didn't want me to put this slide up. But okay, what's a back of the paper napkin test? All right, I know that I have a pipe that is so wide. What's the magic number? Or at least a starter number. Okay, don't call it a magic number. Call it a starter number that I can work from so that I can kind of put my thumb in the air and say, if I have a T1 plugged into that site, how many concurrent RDS or VDI connections can I have at a time? And a starter number here, again, with all due caveats, obviously, 56K or so. When you start adding graphics, things get harder. When you start adding in remote printing, when you start adding in remote drives and all of that jazz, this number goes up pretty dramatically. But back of the napkin test, about 56K or so. What I find is that when people have problems with their both RDS and their VDI instances, they sometimes forget that the bandwidth actually needs to be concurrent for concurrent users that are actively working. So spend some time and look at the network statistics that actually exist in your environment. I was going to do a really freaking awesome remote FX demo. But then I decided, you know what? I'm going to leave that actually for the product team, because they did all that work and they deserve the accolades for how awesome those demos are. I mean, I'm honest to God, you have to go see this session, because seriously, as a professional presenter, you can actually produce goosebumps on demand, but these are for real. The level of effort and investment that's gone into creating a remote effects experience is just awesome. Yeah. Oh, the time is wrong. When is that time? 3:15? Sorry, 3:15. Sorry, you sent me that slide. Because he sent it to me as a picture, and I'm like, dude, send it to me in text. So 3:15 then tomorrow. But definitely check this out, because these guys have some demos that'll just knock your socks off. They're just really impressive. Don't forget IOPS, too. In fact, if you spend any time playing around with VDI, you recognize that IOPS is king. Many IOPS issues actually happen for when we click buttons. And so if your intent is to create a virtual world where you can do whatever you want during the day and not have to spend time in the evenings, you're in for a rude awakening. Because boot storms and logon storms, and very specifically maintenance storms, where you're trying to do things while people are using machines, can cause a big problem. A lot of people also do not scale their storage for peak usage. In fact, there is a beautiful, beautiful paper that was written by Jim, I forget his last name, from Atlantis Computing, called IOPS for Windows 7. And what he did is actually deconstruct this whole very complicated, very academic IOPS equation down into exactly how you go about looking in perfmon at certain counters and then converting them into exactly how many minutes it'll take for your machines to boot. Beautiful white paper. I should have put a link up here for you, but it's a guy from Atlantis Computing, and it's Windows IOPS for Windows 7. If you look at the metrics that, for example, Citrix has pushed as their steady state metrics for IOPS, they are so off the mark for actual reality as to be almost amusing. In that if you limit IOPS to what that number is, Windows will take somewhere around 24 days to boot. So if you've not familiarized yourself with IOPS and storage and how that actually functions, spend some time, because this will be the bane of your existence whenever you make that move. And I'll talk here in just a minute about some evolving mindsets, but keep an eye on this. Also, don't forget to ignore the users. Anybody get that? Don't forget ignoring the users, or don't, whatever. When you, so net-net, and this, so I'm taking off my IT pro hat and I'm putting on my analyst hat. When you ask the analysts, one of the hardest parts about VDI is user acceptance, because there is this sort of magic number, somewhere around 30 seconds between when the user clicks a button and when they want to start to work. And if you go above that number, you'd lose your user acceptance. So 30 seconds from the time they click that link to provision the VM, boot it, inject the apps, log in, and deliver the control to the user. The biggest VDI project killer is logon time today. So I want to close with not so much a mistake, but just a question. And this is an honest question. This is not me trying to lead you in a direction, because I just honestly don't know. And also because we are relatively new in some of these technologies that we have in Windows Server 2012. And our whole belief system about how to deploy VDI is based off of what we know today. And it has to do with clustering hosts. And in fact, I would love to debate this with you later on if you'd like to come meet me and we'll go over beers and chat about it. Because I don't know. Today, we have VDI. In this TechNet article, What's New in RDS, you find that this is, I copied this out of Microsoft's documentation. It says, With VDI, you can use less expensive storage. So you can use inexpensive local storage with live migration functionality between host computers for pooled virtual desktops, and personal virtual desktops can use the less expensive SMB central storage. So it gets me thinking, have you done any talking about storage? Have you played with storage in 12 yet? You know about SMB3, which what used to be 2.2, but then they elevated it up by an integer? The new advancements and the investments in these technologies are really, really compelling, potentially. So in the classic way, there was this complex build where in order to create this VDI environment, we had to take all these hosts and point them to a single central SAN. And that SAN had storage. It was expensive storage. I could centralize it. I could live migrate stuff around. Do I need that? I can't, in my mind, really, you know, think about what do I care? They're users. If I lose, you know, a host and I can move the stuff over and a couple of users go down, what do I care about live migration? Do I really need it? This is really, really awesome because I can live migrate, but what do I pay? All the way down there at the storage. I have all this contention potential because I have a single disk image and then I've got all these differencing disks that are all pointed to the same image. So I end up kind of creating this path where all paths lead to Rome and Rome is the VHD file. So it gets me thinking. Okay, so built into 12 is this radically impressive 2012 SMB stuff that allows me to have really, really fast disk. And even built into 08, honestly. So why not have the disk local, right? In 2012, I bet you didn't know this, you can live migrate without a cluster. Did you know that? So without having a cluster, I could live migrate around if I needed to, just a load balance. Suddenly my process gets ridiculously simple. I don't have any HA, but do I care? In 2012, I could also take that really complex storage and put up this new technology called a scale out file server technology that allows me to take all of my storage and then just put it, turn all of my SANs into a NAS, more or less. Well, with that, it becomes simple for me. I just deploy them wherever I need, and this thing takes care of it, and SMB takes care of all the performance so everything works, and suddenly it gets scalable, but I don't know. So hopefully some of these will kind of just pique your mind that, you know, RDS is out there, so is VDI, and VDI today has got some ways of doing things that may be great or may not be great, and VDI tomorrow has some ways of doing things that may be great or may not be great. And hopefully you've learned something here and can take it back and really, really, really improve the way that you deploy the applications to your users. I will tell you, there are a lot of mistakes you can make with RDS and VDI. In fact, number 20 and 21 is thinking you can get through 22 mistakes in 75 minutes. Number 22 is also not appreciating all of you today. Thanks for your time. Please don't forget my friends and all of these great updated or upcoming presentations on RDS and remote effects. Please don't forget evaluations, too. That's what helps us know how we're doing and all of that. I really honestly appreciate it. Have a great day.